The following message is copyrighted by Westminster Theological Seminary. Duplication, distribution, or other use of all or any part of this message is not permitted without prior written consent. Please direct your inquiries to communications@wts.edu. For all other information, please visit the main website at www.wts.edu.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Stafford. It's an unusual introduction for me. I can usually tell which part of the country I'm in, whether they refer to the Guinness Book of Records rather tamely, or refer to the beer. And in Christian circles, it's usually the former, not the latter. But coming from a fellow Irishman, he would understand that actually the family makes both of them together. No, it's a real pleasure, as you mentioned. Our family, who founded the brewery as Christians in an age that was called the Age of Gin, where on the one hand you had the hazards of dirty water, and on the other hand the hazards of gin drunkenness, Christians drank what they call fortified lemonade, namely beer. And many of the great European breweries were actually founded by not only Christians, but by evangelicals. And certainly ours was, but you can also imagine that there were various tangles into which people got because of that. One of my favorite stories, a real story, is of one of my ancestors who was for a long time Ireland's most generous philanthropist. And as a Christian, he gave all that he gave anonymously. And one of the biggest things he gave was the rebuilding of St. Patrick's Cathedral. He gave to the poor and the homeless and many, many millions in that area too. But he rebuilt St. Patrick's Cathedral, which is Ireland's largest church. And the city fathers came to him and said, would he allow an exception and they could just discreetly acknowledge what he'd done? And at first he refused, and then he said, well, if you assure me, it will be very discreet. Well, St. Patrick's Cathedral was reopened, and you can see the stained glass window today. It's a kind of tourist point of interest. You can see the stained glass window, and as the curtains went back, you have a picture from the Gospels and a verse and a discreet thanks to the Guinness family. And in their great wisdom, the city fathers, who obviously had not been to Westminster Seminary, put as the text underlying the thanks to the Guinnesses, I was thirsty, and you gave me to drink. More serious things this morning. There's a famous little incident in European history when Otto von Bismarck, the great Chancellor of Germany, was talking to a friend on the edge of the 20th century. And the friend asked him, what would be the decisive factor in the 20th century? And Bismarck answered famously, it will be the fact that Americans speak English. Now, we from that side of the world might dispute that. But obviously, he was correct. In his day, the British Empire was the largest, strongest force on earth. And within 20 years, it declined and faded. And the vacuum was filled not by the victor of a European conflict, but by the United States. And the last century was the American century. Now, in the same spirit, people are asking today, what are the decisive factors in the 21st century? And I'm moved by the fact that three of the deepest have both a grand strategic and geopolitical dimension and an obviously spiritual dimension. The first great question for our century, will Islam modernize peacefully? I'm not addressing that this morning, a monumental challenge, but not inconceivable. The second great question, which faith will replace Marxism-Leninism in China? As China takes her place as the third great superpower region of the modern world. Clearly, the Marxist Party is still in control. But the Marxist ideology has been hollowed out. And Chinese scholars and many leaders are asking, what will be China's ethic, ideology, faith, philosophy that will undergird capitalism, that will undergird human rights, possibly undergird democracy in the future? Will it be a mild or a harsh form of authoritarianism, a reformed Confucianism, a restored Buddhism? Or could it be in 20 years' time that the Christian faith will truly be a majority faith in China? A huge question for the world, and of course, immensely significant for the Church of Christ. But the third great question is the one I want to address this morning. Will the West recover or sever its relation to its roots? No great civilization endures and prevails if it cuts its roots. And yet that's what we are on the verge of doing. As it's put simply, the central feature of our modern world is globalization. The central carrier of globalization is the West, not Islam, not the East, the West. The single strongest set of beliefs that has made the West is not something coming from the Greeks or the Romans, much though we owe to them, but from the Christian faith. And yet, we're on the verge, as it's put, of a post-Christian West and a post-Western Christian Church. Second, of course, with dimensions that are immensely encouraging. And much of the liveliness of what's here, and we heard last night, comes from that simple fact. But the first, a post-Christian West, is surely a potential fact of immense sadness for those of us who are followers of Christ and for whom the West is our Jerusalem and our Judea. Now, obviously, that fact, and we're not there yet, leaves us and many people in this country with a simple choice. Do we give up and say that it's all over for whatever reason? And there are many who are saying that today in the name of being a faithful subculture or a faithful remnant. Or worse, in the name of heading for the hills and reading the Left Behind books, with many disillusioned by their political and other forms of activism over the last 30 years. And in many parts of the country, I hear that little phrase, it's all over, the door is closed, it's too late. Or do we engage again and by God's grace seek to win back our civilization? And that's what I want to argue for this morning, and argue that we should be on the edge of what could be described as a third mission to the West, in the sense that the first mission to the West was the conversion of the Roman Empire, a staggering achievement under the Lord. The second mission to the West, the conversion of the barbarian empires in the centuries 5th, 6th, 7th, and 8th centuries, not so well known, but another staggering achievement under God, and the so-called gentling of the barbaric and violent tribal European people and the laying of the foundations for what became Christendom. But can we commit ourselves to thinking that over the next 100 years, some of the spheres taking longer than others, such as, say, the university worlds, in the light of the Great Commission, we who are followers of Jesus in the West, for whom the West is our Jerusalem, our Judea, not for the West's sake, not for America's sake, not for democracy's sake, not for Europe's sake, but for Christ's sake, out of obedience to the Great Commission, to seek once again to fan out as they did from Judea, to fan out later as they did from Skellig Michael and other tiny places in the dark days after the fall of the Roman Empire, and once again, for Christ's sake, to win back our Jerusalem, our Judea, our Western world, for Christ's sake. Let me, in the time we have, I want to leave time for discussion, just set out a number of propositions dealing with some of the challenges and some of the opportunities we face. First, we have to confront three great anti-Christian prejudices comprising an ABC moment in the West, an anything but Christianity moment. It's a feature of cultures in decline that they turn against their old faith. And clearly in the West, the old faith is the Christian faith. And you can see the mounting prejudice. Some have called it persecution. I think that's far too strong. Certainly discrimination. Certainly prejudice. An enormous amount vented after the last election, for instance. And as you examine it, you see that much of it is fair. We have earned it. Much of it is unfair. It is ludicrously off the mark. And yet we will have to pick up our crosses and follow our Lord, not whining, not playing the victim card, realizing that the next maybe 50 or 60 years, we will have to face and surmount very powerful prejudice. The first great source are the evils and the excesses of Christendom. The church, of course, has been the center and soul of the very highest passion for justice and reform in the West. And yet in any public discussion today, immediately will be the Crusades, the Inquisition, the slaughter of the Albigensians, and other evils and excesses of Christendom, which were real, which were evil, and which were done, sadly, by followers of Christ in the name of Christ. The second great source are the reactions and the repudiations of the Enlightenment. Again, in some ways absurd. Brothers like St. Augustine, Isaac Newton, Blaise Pascal, Jonathan Edwards, giants of the mind who were passionately in love with Jesus Christ. And yet following the Enlightenment, all of us who believe are dummies and reactionary and have a face that's essentially irrational. I was reading a fascinating exchange on the internet last year when certain of the secularists were describing they should give up the word humanist because it had become an epithet. And several of them were suggesting the word that they should pick up, they should call themselves the brights, because we who believe are the dimmies and the dummies. What extraordinary arrogance in the light of history, and yet in the light of the Enlightenment, so-called, an understandable stigma that we will bear for some time. And the third, rather more contradictorily, the people of faith are harmlessly innocuous and dangerously extremist together. I was often puzzled by how those two contradictory criticisms could almost be made often 5 minutes apart, until I began to realize they're very closely related. It's actually because of the erosions of modernity that faith has been reduced to the place where, having lost its integrity and effectiveness, it is often harmlessly innocuous. And yet precisely when it's there, it is open to being exploited by various political ideologies and then becomes dangerously extremist. In a radical form, Islamism. In a far milder form, say, the Republican reliance on evangelicalism. I've heard one of the White House operatives in the last year refer to evangelicals with a Marxist term, the useful idiots, the people you have to need in order to be elected. But once elected, don't take that seriously. Clearly, not playing the victim card, as I said, unlike the Christian right, we need to pick up our crosses and follow our Lord, recognizing that through these factors in Western history, we will have to face deep and serious prejudice. Secondly, we will have to face three fundamental distortions of religion in the modern world. The simple fact is that our faith, along with all religions, has been profoundly damaged by modernity. We can say simply that modernity, the world that's risen since the Industrial Revolution, ranging from urbanization, industrialization, bureaucratization, right down to telecommunications, modernity has done more damage to religions of all sorts than all the persecutors in history, and certainly that's true of the Christian faith too. Normally that's analyzed in terms of forces like secularization. But let me just mention three things commonly remarked on at the high noon of modernity, or the advanced stages of modernity. The first, the almost complete shift from community to individualism. I crossed the floor of the Christian booksellers a couple of years ago with one of the leading publishers. And knowing some of the books I'd written, he said, "I'm embarrassed to come down these hallways with you." Because he said, "I've got to admit that 90% of these books are about I, myself, and me." And whether it's our books or our renewal worship or many things, much of the faith today is chronically and inextricably individualistic and has lost its collective and corporate and community dimension. Equally, if not more importantly, the shift from authority to preference. One of the central features of the modern world is the way it's eroded the link between belief and behavior. So what people believe and how they behave has no necessary link at all. We can see this very clearly in Catholic circles with a concern last year over the politicians who personally say we're opposed to abortion, but who were they to impose their beliefs on the wider society? And the bishops and others considering whether they should withhold the sacraments from people like that. But of course, the same is true in evangelical circles. Put simply, never have evangelicals had higher, sharper, clearer views of the authority of Scripture. But never has the chaos of evangelical behavior on the ground been more extreme. The leader of the National Prayer Breakfast Movement was just telling me last year, as one simple example, he was deeply saddened when the manager of the Washington Hilton, where the prayer breakfast takes place every year, said to him, did he realize that the hotel's annual spike in pornography watching is when the prayer breakfast comes to town? And one could multiply examples all over the place. The incredible break between belief and behavior, so that authority has been softened into preference. And the third one, equally obvious in a great seminary like this, the shift from exclusiveness and absoluteness to syncretism. One finds bizarre polls. 40% of American atheists believe in the resurrection and remain atheists. Evangelicals who believe in the resurrection and reincarnation, or who read their Bible every day and their horoscope. Now, of course, no one reads the horoscope with 100% seriousness, but clearly, perhaps many don't read their Bibles any longer with 100% seriousness. You can see in the mix and match cafeteria style of modern pluralism a general loss of exclusiveness and absoluteness and a shift to syncretism. Thirdly, we've got to face three great oddities of communicating today. And I mention this because as followers of Jesus, we are communicators. And we're in the age of communication. So you often get the impression in many Christian circles, we are communicators in the great age of communication, so we can win the world by tomorrow afternoon. And again it's announced, this mission, that initiative, and so on. winning the world by the end of this decade, it somehow never seems to happen. But the fact is that although we're in the age of communication, there are various oddities about modern communication which in some ways make it much harder to communicate than ever. And let me mention just three. First, an obvious one, inattention. Put simply, never have our technologies of communication been cheaper and more advanced and more accessible. Just take the internet, for instance. But what this has created is simply, as it's put, a culture suffering from ADD. Everybody's speaking, hardly anybody's listening. In other words, on top of the old spiritual and moral deafness of the disobedient is a modern layer of inattention. And actually, to speak simply and freshly and powerfully, really to be heard in an age of modern technology, is harder than ever, not easier. The second oddity is what's called inflation. Non-economic inflation, that we know well, and that we can handle easily with a good Paul Volcker or Alan Greenspan. But the real problem of inflation in America is in the area of either sources or ideas. An obvious example is American advertising, where the brilliance and the sharpness brought to bear on selling the most trivial things in the most irrational ways is extreme. But take an example that's affecting Christian circles much more deeply, the inflation because of ghostwriting. Take speeches and sermons and books. In the old days, if you heard a speech, or you received a letter, or you read a book, it was almost always, you could be sure, from the person who purported to write it and sign it, or whose name was on the cover, or whatever. Not today. Take an example that's understandable. Last year in Washington, there was a huge 3 months debate over who put those 16 words in the State of the Union on Niger. They were wrong. Who put it in? CIA, the Defense Department, the State Department, the NSC? A huge debate and investigation. Nobody in 3 months that I heard ever asked, did the president put it in? Because you know presidents don't write a word they say, unlike, say, Lincoln's great speeches. They're all written by ghostwriters. Now transfer that to Christian circles. When the huge bulk of our celebrity authors and bestsellers are not in any way written by the people whose names are on the covers. When increasingly we have pastors fired because they're downloading sermons by great preachers like Tim Keller. In other words, where is the element of thus saith the Lord? I remember Dr. Lloyd-Jones. The hour before he entered the pulpit, he spoke to no one. Few hundred yards from Buckingham Palace, if the Queen had come, he wouldn't have spoken to her because he was in the presence of the King of Kings. And he never said, thus saith the Lord, when he preached. But he didn't need to because you knew before whom he'd studied and you knew before whom he'd prayed and you knew before whose presence he entered that pulpit, and there was no ghost writing. There was no ghost preaching. And you can see in all these cases, the less authenticity, the less authority. And Christian language today, both in our books and increasingly in many of our sermons, is suffering seriously from inflation. And much of it floats away like the jingles that surround our advertising in this country. The third great oddity of communicating today is what's called inertia. When democracy came in, people feared that it would be volatile and dangerously vulnerable to demagoguery. With universal suffrage, with universal education, with universal literacy, ideas would flow fast, freely, and furiously, and there would be extraordinary shifts in opinion. And Tocqueville, as usual, understood something very different. In a monarchy, you only have to change one mind to change the country, the king's. In an aristocracy, only a few minds to change the country, the elite. But in a democracy, you have to change many minds, and so it will be much slower. And studies show that there's an odd paradox. Here we are in a fast-moving world of information. So on the one hand, our reflexes are faster than ever. And you look at our split screens today, and in the top, the Dow Jones flashing up. At the bottom, the latest baseball or football scores. And in the middle, a new suicide bombing, beheading in Iraq or whatever. Split screen, fast moving. Our reflexes, faster than ever. But our reflections, how we are thinking, how we are forming our conclusions, how we are changing our minds, slower than ever. And actually, to really change the hearts and minds of people today in any great number is a slower task than ever before. I think in all three cases, it throws us back to realizing that in the age of communication, in some ways, it's harder to communicate than ever before. And if ever we needed the power of the Holy Spirit and the power of the scandal of the cross, it's in our world today when we're tempted to trust in modern insights and modern technologies rather than the gospel itself. Fourth point. Three reminders of why some ideas are more equal than others. Again, there are many Christians who quote Richard Weaver. Ideas have consequences. Dead right. But then, of course, they move on almost in an unspoken way. Ideas have consequences. And we, as followers of Jesus, have the true ideas. And with the truth, if we really express our Christian faith with truth and its worldview power, then we should have extraordinary consequences. But we forget that ideas, true, false, have flow lines. And if we don't understand the flow lines of how ideas spread, you can have true ideas, powerful ideas, and be completely marginal. Now, that sounds like many people doing the Lord's work in the world's way. No, no. Look at St. Paul, trusting only in the power of the Spirit, preaching nothing but the centrality of the cross, and yet clearly moving from the eastern end of the Roman Empire with a clear idea of the western end, Spain, in his mind, and always aiming for the center and Rome, and on his way there, picking up provincial capitals such as Athens and so on. An extraordinary mixture of absolute radical reliance on the Lord and a very canny astuteness as to what he was doing. There are three simple principles that many Christians need to acknowledge in terms of dealing with our modern world. The first, very obvious. The second and third, not quite so obvious. The first, that leaders outweigh followers. I only say this because most evangelicals since the Second Awakening are chronically populist, thinking that mass movements and that ordinary people are the way to make a difference. And you can see in our world, the contrary to that, it's actually those who win the hearts and minds of gatekeepers, those who are astride the doorways of influence and power, whose ideas really spread. The second is not so obvious, that the center of a culture always outweighs the periphery. And I don't mean the geographical center, as London is in England or Paris is in France, but the cultural center. And of course, this country has no geographical center. So New York is the financial capital. Los Angeles and Hollywood is the entertainment capital, and Washington is the political capital. There's no geographical center of the United States, but there are decisive cultural centers. And you can see that those who win the center have the influence. The Jews understand this. They recognize openly that as a tiny minority, say 2% of Americans, they need to live close to the center so that their small numbers can have strong influence. So where do they live? New York, Los Angeles, Washington, Chicago. And as a Jewish friend said to me, "And where do you evangelicals live?" Wheaton, Colorado Springs, Orlando. And you wonder why you're marginal. Paul went to Rome. And the third point, equally obvious if you think about it, networks always outweigh individuals and institutions. If you just think of our formal networks in the church, you can see this powerfully. From the disciples, through the Benedictines, through the Moravians, through Wesley's cell groups, through the Clapham Circle and William Wilberforce, through the Inklings. Informal, powerful networks, inspiring, encouraging, holding accountable, with an influence out of all proportion to their numbers. And of course, that's powerfully true today. Fifth point. Three options for the global public square. We've had arguments in this country for a generation about the public square. And now we're beginning to see an emerging discussion of a global public square. So that now something said in one country with modern media is immediately picked up around the world, and no conversation is private. So rude remarks by Jerry Falwell in Lynchburg. A week or two later, riots in Lahore. A clear example of sound carrying across water and the emergence of a global public square. And you can see the beginning of an argument about what should characterize that global public square. I personally think this country, in the last generation, increasingly has it wrong. And not only that, the Christian right in this country is not on the side of the angels, but actually causing much of the problem. But in this country, you can see that the three options we have are two extremes and a middle position that has no champion and is therefore weak. On one extreme, we have what's called the sacred public square. Those who would like to see their faith, the preferred faith in public life. No established faith because of the First Amendment, but the preferred faith, the semi-established, the de facto established faith. And that, of course, represents much of the demands of the religious right over school prayer and many other things. Surely in today's world, not only unjust, not only unworkable, but sadly creating an enormous backlash against itself and against all the people of faith in this country. The other extreme, the so-called naked public square. Those who would like to antiseptically remove all faith from public life, people like the ACLU and Michael Newdow and Americans United. Even more unjust, even less workable, and disastrous not only for people of faith, but for the underpinnings of the American Republic itself. The third position, though sadly, has no champion and is therefore weak. The idea of a civil public square. A public square in which people of all faiths and no faith are free to enter and engage public life on the basis of their faith, but within a framework of what is understood to be just and free for everybody else too. So that a right for a Christian is a right for a Jew, is a right for an atheist, is a right for a Muslim, and for people of any faith in this country. Now, I would suggest to you that the resolution of that argument, which is now the sharp edge of America's culture wars, will be absolutely decisive for the future of this country. As faith and freedom go, so goes America. But more importantly, the outcome of this struggle will be absolutely decisive for the future of the gospel in American public life. And we have a tremendous stake in arguing for a constructive, civil public square and seeing that the reality and the false impressions created by the religious right do not predominate and tarnish us all with their brush. A sixth point. Three openings for faith in public life. Our confidence, finally, first and foremost, is in the Lord and His gospel. Always. But again and again, I'm asked, why is this still a moment of hope? And why is it not all over, as so many are saying? Let me give you three reasons why, in my experience, this is still an extraordinary moment of hope, certainly in this country. The first reason is history. Unlike those who are ignorant of history, or consider history as bunk like Henry Ford, the fact is that almost every major issue today trails off into yesterday in the past and cannot be understood without knowing history and soon becomes inextricably linked with some aspect of the gospel. And so certainly in this country, history is an incredible trump card for people of faith entering public debate. The second reason is the nature of our crises. Sadly, crises recur and recur. And in many, many cases, whether it's a relatively local one like Columbine or a national one like 9/11, you see that immediately you're down below the political and the economic and the legal, down to issues that are cultural and moral, and finally down to issues that are spiritual and fundamentally religious, and only the deepest answers come from the answers of faith. The very nature of these crises means that we have incredible moments for addressing them from the perspective of the gospel. The third reason, again, this is in my experience, is the yearnings of leaders. I've lived in the Washington area now for 20 years. I would say, in my experience, the only people that I have met who are implacably closed and hostile are from one of two positions, either some in the academic world or some in the activist world. But many of the political leaders, many of the business leaders and the leaders of other elite institutions across this country are remarkably open. For one of two reasons in terms of their personal yearnings. One is the yearning for meaning and purpose and fulfillment. Take, for instance, the extraordinary resonance of Rick Warren's book among the highest leaders in business and politics. The other is the yearnings for relationships and their families. And again, I've met Wall Street titans who personally were atheists or agnostics. A teenage daughter in crisis, a 20-year-old son in a mess, and their hearts and minds were remarkably open. In my experience here, unlike Europe, I'm amazed how extraordinarily open the highest leaders are, even although aspects of our culture are moving further and further from the faith. One last quick point. Three requirements for transforming culture. The word transformation is bandied around today almost like a cliche or a buzzword. Someone who challenged me in the use of that word sent me back to friends of mine who are historians, and I asked several of them, when we speak about the church transforming culture, what actually happened in history? And N.T. Wright, Tom Wright, is a close friend of mine, among others, said to me this. He said, what happened, we can say, in first and second centuries and others, is that there's a triple action of the gospel in the church, and then the church in the culture, the combined consequence of which is genuinely transformation. And Tom in particular mentioned three things: affirmation, confrontation, and demonstration. Some of those were strong on today, others rather weaker. Affirmation: clearly in the early church there were no Billy Grahams. There were no C.S. Lewises in terms of mass evangelism or huge readership in apologetics. Most of it was one-to-one. But the fact was that the gospel was always fresher over against the stale beliefs and ideas of the Roman Empire. This new view of God and of humanity and community and truth and justice and beauty. And it was an extraordinary yes to life. We have much of that today. But how much more do we need at a time when people view us as the old and the stale? Confrontation. Yes, there was confrontation in the sense of challenging infanticide, and we today challenge abortion. But you can see with the early church, it wasn't just social justice issues like that, which are so important. It was also spiritual issues. And there was a clear sense that the supernatural power of those who trusted Christ was stronger over against those around them. Are we strong in that today? Many of us in the West would have to say we have been secularized, and we have very little of a supernatural difference over against our friends and neighbors. But it was the third one, surely, that was the most remarkable: demonstration. I'm moved by the fact that again and again in the pagan world, you get the cry going up, "Great is the God of the Christians," because they could see it. It had been shown. Love shown, care shown, food given, justice stood for, or supernatural powers confounded on the evil side by the greater power of the gospel. Great is the God of the Christians, and they had seen it demonstrated. A clear case where our Western individualism almost prevents anything being seen in that demonstrable way like that. Do you believe it's possible, we who are followers of Jesus in the West, to think of winning back the West for Christ? Or in your heart of hearts, do you too believe it's all over? What would have happened if they'd said in the 5th century, "It's all over"? You can see many people today who have truly given up. Things have been far worse in the past. At times in the past, there have been far fewer left to do something about it. And yet, by God's grace, they won it back. And I believe if we trust in God and trust in the gospel, over the next 100 years, under God, we could win back our culture, our civilization for Him. As I say, not because the West is in any way superior, not for the West's sake at all, let alone America's sake or democracy's sake. But simply, our challenge is to be Western followers of Christ. And this is our Jerusalem and our Judea.